me, that's where you're at. When the world is wrong and I'm in the blue, he's the guy that makes me try on my dancing shoes. The more I get, the more I want to sing. And I feature Dr. Jack on my
was Dr. Jazz from Ann Feeney's album, If I Can't Dance, It's Not My Revolution. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Name of the show is Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. Welcome. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours, and coming up in about 15 minutes or so, we'll be having on the air, if he calls in faithfully, Mark Maron, as mentioned before. He's a Sacramento attorney who, with some help from a number of other organizations, is suing the city of Sacramento on behalf of the homeless community there to end the sleeping ban and police harassment of homeless people for engaging in life-sustaining activities at night. I think it's primarily about sleeping. It's also about security of property, the practice of the police to seize and destroy valuable homeless items, such as our own Chief Ranger John Wallace apparently does, as a matter of policy, out in the Poganip and the parks, just for the convenience of the city, you understand, so they don't have to store all that clutter when they run across homeless camps and tear them up and destroy them with their labor-ready crews. This, at least, is what he told me some months ago, and I haven't been informed there's been a change in his policy here in Santa Cruz. We'll see how things are going with the Sacramento lawsuit. The Santa Cruz sleeping ban lawsuit, as you may know, if you're listening to this show, has essentially gone under for lack of funds and some other attorney problems that we've had. But that doesn't stop us from continuing to speak up for the rights of homeless people here and to try to advise folks as to different ways to get together to end laws that criminalize the poor in Santa Cruz, just like has happened in Los Angeles, San Diego, Fresno, Richmond, and now Sacramento, if the lawsuit there is successful. We're going to be hearing that soon, hopefully, when Mark Maron calls in. Before that, however, a little something about the upcoming election. There's a city council election coming up in November. 4 seats are up. There are 4 retiring council members, or at least two of whom actually are retiring, 2 of whom are running again. Coonerty and Madrigal are running again. That's Ryan Coonerty, the mayor, Tony Madrigal, council member. And then there are 2 open seats being vacated by Ed Porter and Emily Riley. I've expressed my disappointment, my profound disappointment with the council, well, for many a moon, on basic homeless human rights issues. And I think it's really important we be clear what people are going to do and what they're not going to do. But it's also useful to get a broader perspective on, well, you can see how the political process doesn't work, actually, is probably the best way to describe it. By examining the answers that the candidates give to questions that are posed to them, and perhaps even more important, the kinds of questions that are asked, because a lot of the time candidates get a free ride because the wrong questions are asked or the important questions are just not posed. Today is Thursday. I guess it was Tuesday evening. There was a forum at the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, and supposedly it was open to the public, and hence I invited video journalist Becky Johnson to come with a camera. She was also helping Craig Canada, one of the city council candidates. But when both of them looked on the internet at the SEIU website, they found there was no mention of the forum. And so they assumed the forum either didn't exist or had been canceled or had gotten the wrong day. But the forum did, in fact, go on. And when I arrived with my audio recorder, I found that only the most conservative mainstream recycled candidates were being given an opportunity to speak. Those were the five city council members or former mayors, and they included Tim Fitzmaurice, Ryan Coonerty, Tony Madrigal. Jane Weed was there representing Catherine Byers, and there was actually a sixth candidate who I want to mention by name just out of courtesy, although actually there's a thick packet that gave out David Teresis, and there was Don Lane, who was a mayor in the early 90s and has been a perennial social service, you might say, well, poverty pimp is a nasty way to put it, but he has been getting a lot of money for allegedly performing services for poor and homeless people when a number of us have felt on a number of occasions that, well, homeless people themselves could do better with the money than he did, and that it would be better if there was a direct person from the homeless community doing that kind of stuff. That's when he was the staff person for the Homeless Issues Task Force, Don Lane was, way back in 1999. Anyway, there were a number of people at this forum. Six of the ten candidates, the four candidates who were not represented, were Lisa Milineau, Craig Canada, who was apparently said he was never contacted by the SEIU, Simba Kenyatta, whose name you've heard on the station before because he's been working with the Coalition for Community Justice. That's my kind of abbreviation for the name of the group that has been concerned with police misconduct and racism and has been holding forums around the county. I've been critical of it for not doing much more than hold forums, but at least they've been holding public forums, sort of public forums. They don't broadcast their forums. And then there's one other additional candidate who I actually met. I think his name is Jacob, and I've actually invited him to contact the show and be on the air because he seems to be a somewhat alternative candidate, but he wasn't there either. There were only the it's sort of like only inviting the Democrats and the Republicans, not inviting the Greens, the Peace and Freedom Party, the Libertarians, the American Independent Party, the minor parties, and so forth, so-called minor parties. And I found that kind of disconcerting. And in the past, as I recall, I have audio taped these forums for later play on free radio. However, I was approached in a somewhat controlling manner, one might even say thuggish manner, by Smedberg, I believe his name is, who informed me that I would not be allowed to audio tape. And I inquired why. Why would this be? And he said, well, you might take fragments of it and use it inappropriately. And I said, well, if that's your concern, why don't I give you the tape recorder and the tape? You record it so the public can have a record of this hour and a half forum, which a number of the candidates said, at least one said, was the most important forum of the entire election season, so the rest of the community could be aware of what these candidates were saying publicly on these issues, unless there was some reason that the SEIU wanted to conceal this kind of stuff and have it behind closed doors. Now, the reason that they gave me was, well, this is for our members, and you're only a guest. And this is not a Brown Act meeting. Brown Act is the act that requires official government bodies to inform people of the meetings in advance, allow tape recording, and so forth. And I said, that really is irrelevant. There are all kinds of public meetings that aren't Brown Act meetings, and they're public meetings. If you have a public meeting, such as the ACLU had and will be having again this year, every year they have an annual public meeting. When Mike Rockin tried to keep me out of that public meeting, tried to have me arrested for having a sign, the police told him, you can't do that, Mayor Rotkin or Councilmember Rotkin or ACLU guy Rotkin. This is a public meeting. You've already advertised it as such. And he had to let me in. And the same is really true here. But, well, your ace reporter, rather than get thrown out by SEIU heavies or otherwise mishandled, succumbed to pressure. And I didn't tape record the meeting, but did take a lot of notes. And I'm going to be talking about that and playing tape on it, which I did some interviews after the meeting. And I believe Becky Johnson is writing a story. She was there. She did show up with a video camera anyway, just to see what was going on, even though she sort of assumed that there was no meeting because it wasn't mentioned on their website. This kind of stealth approach where the community is sort of left out of the equation and the only issue is between the candidates and these organizations as to whether they want to endorse them or not, I find really a kick in the ass to the rest of us and a sad kind of commentary, and interestingly, a kind of a telling reflection of what the city council process itself is. And Ryan Coonerty was the mayor who has mandated the new abbreviated public be damned process at city council, was sitting square in the middle of this table of candidates. And I'll probably be talking a little bit about the statements they made. It was depressing to be at, and it was, I guess, Becky Johnson gave the impression, you'll hear her saying afterward, I interviewed her a little bit about it, it was kind of boring. But if you're concerned about city government, and you think that cities should be addressing such things as community control of police and rent control and public access to city council and basic rights for poor and homeless people, such as ending the sleeping ban law and reopening public spaces downtown, which are greedily being devoured by the merchants and in a plan cooked up by the redevelopment agency and the police, such as the chained-off area in front of New Leaf Market. A chain apparently was stolen last night. When I came by this morning, I was advised by one of the homeless folks sitting there who was eating his breakfast at one of the tables inside the chained area. One chain was up and one chain was down. They said the chain was taken during the night. Apparently what happened was the sign was taken or vandalized, ripped off the chain. The sign says no trespassing. I think it's 8 p.m. to 9 a.m. or 9 p.m. to 8 a.m., something to that effect. And it's now being repaired. In any case, this whole business of excluding all but the favored, the moneyed, the well-to-do, those who are in the know or close to the wheels of power is really sad and disagreeable, and it needs to be fought. And so I'm going to be doing my best to expose it as I usually do on this program. And that's going to happen more later in the show because I'm approaching the time when I'm expecting Mark Maron to call in. I'm going to talk a little bit about Mark's lawsuit. He'll be talking about it. There were a couple of items in the Sacramento Bee. $2.3 million settlement in Fresno may boost rights of the homeless. I've talked, of course, to Mike Rhodes, who's an activist in Fresno, about Sacramento, a city significantly to the north of Fresno and larger. Sacramento, of course, Sacramento is the state capital. And the situation in Sacramento was covered by Mark Maron way back in December. He called into the show, for those of you who'd like to go back and listen to that interview. It was a Thursday evening interview, almost the last Thursday in December of last year, and you can catch that at www.huffsantacruz.org, and then go to the name of the show, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, and click on December 27th, and you'll catch Mark Maron's interview. You have to go toward the end of the audio file. Interesting interview. I had three homeless people in the studio who kind of questioned him. I'm going to be doing the questioning alone. This is going to be a shorter interview because Mark has less time. I actually was anticipating another person calling in who's going to be calling in on Sunday, I believe. That's this aforementioned Mike Rhodes, who was part of the successful Fresno lawsuit. But we're going to be talking today about Sacramento. Here's the kind of the linkage between the two. I'll read this story. Floyd Hopkins, 57. There's a picture of this fellow with a backpack, an old grizzled guy with a mustache and long hair. I feel like I'm looking in the mirror, except he doesn't have a long beard. I'm a bearded fellow myself. Floyd Hopwood, 57, is a plaintiff in a class-action lawsuit by homeless people who accuse the city of Sacramento of confiscating their possessions without due process. And I think we're about to hear about that straight from the horse's mouth. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Mark Maron. I'm calling in from Sacramento.
Hey, Mark. I was just about to read the story in the Sacramento Bee of June about the $2.3 million settlement in Fresno may boost rights of the homeless, and that had a picture of Floyd Hopwood, one of your plaintiffs, on the front page. Maybe you could pick it up from there and summarize what the lawsuit is about and tell us where we're at.
Well, you're going to read about the Fresno settlement.
Well, the Fresno settlement was in the Sacramento Bee, but they mention a lot of Sacramento plaintiffs.
Okay. Well, I thought maybe you wanted to go ahead and read it so your listeners know what we're talking about.
Well, I could. I have actually, for the regulars, this has been talked about rather extensively in the past. We've also had Mike Rhodes in the studio, and we'll be having him again calling in on Sunday to give an update from Fresno.
Well, okay. I guess my pleasure at seeing the Fresno settlement knows no bounds, and the reason is that they've plowed some great ground, but we have a much larger field. In other words, they had some pretty focused sweeps in Fresno that resulted in the destruction of property, very serious denial of due process for a lot of folks. But our situation is that we have a much larger area where people have been trying to survive outside over a number of years, and the callousness of the authorities has resulted in literally thousands of people losing their means of survival, their bedrolls, their medications, if they have any silverware or mess kits, all that stuff just tossed into the dumpster, or in the more compassionate instances, perhaps trundled out to some remote area and held for some limited period of time. People can't get to it and can't be identified in any event, so it's essentially confiscated and destroyed. So our case is a lot bigger than the Fresno case, involves a lot more people and a lot more money, but a lot of the issues have already been settled, and that's what's very nice about it.
Yeah, the $2.3 million settlement in Fresno, which I guess kicked down about a million of that to the attorneys, but the rest is going to homeless people if they can only sort it out. And that confusion and difficulty and delays by the city, we're going to talk about that on Sunday on the show.
Uh-huh.
And get Mike Rhodes's on-the-scene analysis. It essentially came about through a lot of photographic and videoed evidence of direct destruction of homeless property through bulldozing and dumpsterizing what was obviously not trash. We've, in Santa Cruz, not yet put together that kind of evidence. And indeed, that was why they got, I guess, according to Rhodes, three major legal firms that were all from out of town to come into Fresno to help the lawsuit. On the other hand, in Sacramento, you and some local organizations like Shock and other groups have taken this on yourselves, for which I commend you. And of course, here in Santa Cruz, we're trying to figure out how to get something going ourselves. We've attempted to do a sleeping band lawsuit. We haven't been successful so far in two runs, and that's one of the reasons I'm talking to you tonight, is to get some tips on how other localities can do what Fresno has done, what Los Angeles and San Diego have done, and apparently what you're doing.
You're right. We don't have the type of video documentation that they had in Fresno. In fact, when we've gotten word of sweeps and shown up there equipped to document what was going to happen, surprisingly, they don't occur. In other words, the city and the county are really trying to avoid public destruction of evidence and thereby avoid playing into our own hands in terms of giving us the evidence of their violations. What we do have, however, are hundreds of declarations of people who have stated under oath, this is what happened to me, when it happened, where I was, who the witnesses were. And that's kind of irrefutable evidence in the face of a total absence of rebuttal evidence from the county. I mean, what the public entities are saying is, we don't destroy property, we dispose of trash. And and we don't keep track of the trash that we dispose of. So if you lost something, it must have been indistinguishable to us from trash. So then it becomes really an expert line of inquiry. You just you ask what efforts they made to distinguish between trash and the personal belongings of homeless members who happen to be out trying to get a meal or raise some funds for the day, and you find that they really don't make any efforts. They have some officers whose primary duty it is to relate to the homeless population here, and they will really help us. We're about to take their depositions next week. I suspect they're going to help us because they're going to say, sure, they know where the homeless are, and they know what kind of encampments they have, and they know what kind of private property they maintain. And I don't think that that's going to play so well against the public entity's denial of any records of confiscation.
And yet these people are employed by those public entities, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So you think that they are going to risk their jobs by telling the truth to you?
I think it's strange, and but quite believable that officers whose duty it is to have a beat that really intersects with the homeless population comes to know them and actually like them, because you know, there's really no difference between homeless people and people who have homes in terms of their concerns, their personalities, their ability to relate as human beings, and they're often quite compassionate. I mean, I wouldn't lump to be, or try to characterize them, but officers can't end up just hating everybody. And they it's our experience that there are some civil officers. They may have to do a job they don't like to do, but these two officers are reputed to be fairly compassionate. They're city officers. And even though we had to sue them because they were the face of the public entity, there was actually a lot of opposition to putting the blame on them for city policy.
Huh. Well, I know that I've heard of the very rare officer who's resigned rather than, you know, arrest a homeless person for sleeping at night. That happened in New York City 5 years ago or something. And, you know, there are, of course, officers who are fairly nice, but you often have, I find, in Santa Cruz and larger cities, is a kind of a blue coat of silence, and the primary loyalty is to the organization, the police organization, although, you know, that can break down if there's a lot of corruption and violence in the organization.
Well, I think, you know, I'm not on a crusade to extol law enforcement, but in our setting we have city and county people, and we have sheriffs work brigades who are really just people who are doing time by coming in on work projects, and we have park rangers. So in this particular situation, we have officers, city officers, who even warn the homeless in encampments that a sweep is being planned, or they should try to hang on to their belongings because a work brigade is going to be coming through disposing of trash. So that is a conflict that we hope to exploit, frankly.
Now, it's interesting. You say you're taking depositions, and I know that in the one lawsuit that I've been involved in, two lawsuits recently in the last 10 years, depositions are expensive matters, and that's one of the reasons that we tried to raise some money to get our own sleeping ban lawsuit overturned, and we kind of estimated that in order to get stuff done here, we needed $10,000 to $15,000. What kind of a budget is required to mount a lawsuit in a large city like Sacramento against you're trying to get not just one law, but a number of laws, number of police practices ended regarding the homeless, right?
Yes. Well, I hate to talk money in these kinds of situations, because once you get there, if that's what's motivating you, then you don't do this kind of law.
It's not so much that I want you to say that. It's more in practical terms, in order to get this thing started, you have to, even if the attorneys are operating pro bono, as our attorneys were, and as I don't know if you are or not, but...
Well, sure, we are. That's really what...
But you need to pay court costs, you need to pay expert testimony, depositions, and things like that.
Yes, you do.
And so what do you estimate, how much are you going to estimate this is going to cost you and your side to mount this lawsuit?
Well, it so far costs us about $8,000, and we expect to spend probably another $20,000. Just getting through depositions and probably some motions, but we're actually going to try to do this on a fairly small budget and get to trial. Or there's some talk about getting into a mediation, which would be a reasonable approach if the policymakers want to try to deal with the problem and come up with some acceptable solutions.
So, in order to get this kind of money, did you have, you know, were some angels stepping forward?
There are angels, and a lot of people don't want to come forward and say where it comes from, but we have some contributors, and we have some supporters, and there are people who, because of their own moral and religious views, want to see something done that's a little more constructive than just round them up and put them in jail, kind of. Approach.
I know that when we spoke last, I was reviewing our December 27th interview. You mentioned that this is the lead plaintiff is Tony Lehr, L-E-H-R.
Yes.
And that the other organizations involved so far are Loaves and Fishes, Francis House, and Sacramento Homelessness Organizing Committee.
Correct.
And, you know, they don't sound like wealthy organizations to me, I'll tell you.
No, they're not. But we've had fundraising events. And it's commendable that the legal community is prepared to step up. And if you look somebody in the eye and he's a fairly well-off attorney and say, hey, we need $500 or $1,000 contribution from your firm to carry on this work, it's surprising how many people will dig into their pockets.
Well, we need you to come to Santa Cruz and start staring at some of our local attorneys. I know also I've read recently that, I guess it was in April maybe, or maybe it was before, an informal tent city that cropped up on a vacant field along North B Street in Sacramento.
Yeah.
I guess this was June. It was dispersed. And it reminded me of a different situation in Fresno where two homeless cities or encampments or mini cities, one called New Jack City, the other called The Hill, are not only still in operation, but the city has donated a porta potty to one of them, admittedly with the ridiculous addition of a 24-hour security guard to guard not the safety of the homeless, but
the
safety
porta-potty.
Of the porta. Yeah, I mean, but I mean, do you have any encampments in Sacramento that where homeless people can maintain community and protect each other, or is that have they been dispersed by the friendly, so sympathetic police department? If you forgive my sarcasm.
Well, we do have an encampment. Which is a little bit strange because, of all places, it's on the abandoned city dump. And it's an area where the city was threatening to do a sweep And by contacting the media and getting folks out there, they decided to call it off. And they were asking that those folks out there clean up after themselves. So we proposed a meeting where our demand was provide facilities, provide sanitary facilities and disposal, trash disposal or dumpsters or something, so that it would be possible to clean it up. Well, the city hasn't been quite prepared to meet with us on that level, but at least they haven't rounded up or disturbed or dispersed the people who are there.
Is that, the encampment have a name?
Yes, actually, it does. It's called the Desert.
And how many people are out there?
Well, I haven't been out there in a few days, but there were at least 20 the last time I was aware of it. It's not large because it's really not that desirable an area. So it's sort of a last-ditch place where people will end up when they've been rousted out of places that have some shade and, you know, and something that commends it.
Yeah, I'm looking at this story, and it's not actually from June. It's from last November. Union Pacific Railroad property near 7th and B Streets in Sacramento was
right.
Apparently the... That was a somewhat larger encampment that was...
Yeah,
dispersed.
That was. And I think we backed the city down, but the railroad, private industry and all, they just came out and fenced the property. So it was... That was the way that encampment was dispersed.
Well, it's interesting. You know, part of the almost 750,000 of the lawsuit settlement that was granted in Sacramento was against, I guess, Caltrans. So
you mean in Fresno?
I mean in Fresno. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I guess what the railroads are more stiff-necked, even though they may face similar penalties, or.
Well, they face penalties for the destruction of property, but they don't face penalties for fencing their property.
Mm-hmm. That's all they
I
did
think
was.
I think Caltrans was a participant in the seizure and destruction of property.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
When we talked last, you mentioned how other cities like New York City has a shelter clause, a clause that everyone is entitled to a right to shelter.
Correct.
And that people aren't taken into custody when homeless. We last talked in December. Have police raids against the homeless in terms of arrests for violating 647J, the state's anti-lodging law, maybe your Sacramento shopping cart laws and other such laws, have these dropped or are they risen, stayed the same?
Well, we've been monitoring the charges brought against homeless persons, and the number of charges brought for crimes that are absolutely clearly identified with homeless, such as camping or possession of camping equipment on public lands or even urinating on public lands, defecating, those kinds of things, they may have come down, but we've seen a rise of other kinds of charges against homeless persons, that is, blocking sidewalks and rapid transit violations, that is,
not
fare jumping, you know, not paying when you're on the streetcar, jaywalking, having a dog off a leash, those kinds of things. And I think it's just sort of another way of hiding the way homeless persons are stigmatized and criminalized.
Now, is this as part of an effort specifically to depopulate an area, socially cleanse an area, such as, for example, was done in the Steinbeck Center in Salinas about 10 years ago when they built that area?
I think that's definitely the motive. There's the city has been pretty open about attributing to downtown merchants the impetus for clearing homeless persons out of public areas. They say it's bad for business.
Mm-hmm.
They want to get them off the mall. They want to get them out of the downtown. They want to get them off of city, county property. And really, the only place they could go then would be the riversides. And the riversides have the the bike trails that are supposedly for recreational purposes, and that then comes right up against the park rangers.
That's the American River Parkway,
yes,
where a lot of homeless people had been living, right?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned back in December that it's much cheaper to spend $8 a day to accommodate a homeless person in a shelter versus $146 a day to keep them in jail.
Absolutely.
What's the shelter situation? Increased, decreased? Shelters are pretty miserable places anyway. I hate to even propose them as alternatives to affordable housing, but if you're going to be arresting people for sleeping, you at least got to have some. You got to be able to say with a straight face, "Well, I offered them at least a shelter bed," and that's not the case in any major city or in Santa Cruz tonight, as far as I know. So, has there been an increase in shelter facilities? Has the city been scrambling to do that, or are they just kind of looking at you and saying, "Ho hum, the Jones settlement happened in Los Angeles, and maybe it'll happen here, maybe it won't"?
I think they have not increased the shelters. That's the short answer. We had a recent homeless count, and I'm just looking to see if I have the documents on my desk here, because what was interesting about it is the numbers actually increased fairly substantially of people who are homeless or sleeping on the streets at any particular night, increased year to year, and they showed the number of people who were actually accommodated in shelters, and it has not risen substantially. So what's happening is that the number of homeless is increasing, but the number of beds for emergency shelter accommodations has not.
You mentioned again in December that there were 11,000 homeless generally. If you look at the figures last year in Sacramento at any one time, and 1,000 per night are on the street unsheltered, compared with 700 who get into shelter out of the total of 1,700, or 750, I think you said. But they don't take families, dogs. They give you only 3 days there. You have to stand in long lines, and then when you get to the front of the line, you may learn there's no space.
Right.
Is it
right.
Still the same situation 8 months later? Or?
It's still the same situation, except it's worse, because now the number of people who are actually on the street is not 1,000 or 1,100 as it was, but it's up to about 2,600 a night.
Hmm. And what about disabled organizations? When we had a seminar, I think I mentioned this to you on the phone call we had earlier this week. Activists from different localities concerned with sleeping ban laws against the homeless, looking at the Los Angeles case and the decision that came down, the Jones decision that I mentioned before, which held briefly, 2 out of 3 judges held that it was cruel and unusual punishment to even cite a homeless person when there was a general situation of lack of shelter in the city. But the ACLU was so nervous about this case being overturned by a higher panel or a larger panel that they went for a settlement on this. And when I talked to you about this way back in December, you said you're going to be using this cruel and unusual punishment argument, which was accepted by one of the appeals courts and may well be accepted again. But you also had larger due process concerns. Can you put that in layman? I mean, it's pretty obvious to even to ordinary people what, you know, people have to sleep at night. But in terms of the law, what's going to give you the winning cards in this case?
Well, I think that to use everything you can, and the idea of having nice precedent to refer to moves us further along. I think that we're still going to be relying on the Eighth Amendment, but because there is such a large percentage of homeless who are disabled in one way or another, it's particularly cruel to take somebody who has a disability and hold them to the same type of standard as you would somebody who is not disabled. In fact, our whole disability rights concept is to try to require employers and owners of accommodation to make accommodation for homeless who have one type of disability or another.
Are you going to be using specifically discrimination against disabled people by authorities in this case as a one leg of your argument?
I don't know that we're going to use it as discrimination. I think what we're going to be talking about is how the Eighth Amendment intersects with the specific situations of homeless persons. And let me just give you an example. If you say to a perfectly able person, let's say, you can't stay overnight in this particular area, let's say, and that may be a public park, and yet the person you're talking to is in a wheelchair who can barely get a block, and the closest place where that person can get food is a block away, then to say that they can't be there has a disproportionate effect on the homeless, on the disabled homeless. Mm-hmm. So I think that if we can document that type of fact pattern, I think we can show that there's a disproportionate effect on homeless persons, and that condition has to be, or disabled homeless persons, and that disability has to be accommodated.
And this is a class action lawsuit which will be usable by not just the named plaintiffs, but by other people who come forward if they can show similar kinds of losses, right?
Well, we've denominated it as a class action, and we will be moving for class certification. And once we get certification, then everybody who fits in the definition of a class is going to be a plaintiff, a class member.
There was that kind of certification in Fresno?
Yes, there was.
How long did it take them to get that certification?
Oh, it took them, I believe it took them about a year.
And you've been doing this lawsuit for, when did you begin it?
It's over a year now.
And are you pretty much, you mentioned you've got another attorney working with you, and you also have a crack team of homeless.
We have a great group of not only lawyers, but other support personnel who are doing various things. We're involved right now in developing a database of homeless persons in Sacramento, which is going to be very detailed and give us the ammunition we need really to talk about the specific needs of our homeless population in Sacramento.
Social service agencies, are they critical, supportive, or mixed about your lawsuit?
That's a good question. I think that they feel that they're on a different track. They have a longer vision, let's say. They're talking about a 10-year plan to end homelessness. So they want resources to be available, and I think that they feel that there's some benefit to having the public be more open to devoting resources to this issue. So in that sense, they're supportive. They're not so supportive when it's their failure to act or misdeeds that become the subject of our scrutiny.
And is that, in fact, a part of the lawsuit?
Well, I think it happens, sure. I think that the failure to provide shelter and services is laid at the feet of the county and city personnel who have those responsibilities.
What about private religious organizations that get funding, in some cases perhaps even unconstitutionally, from city authorities and are supposedly, you know, rather harsh on the homeless, have a bad reputation? I'm thinking of agencies in Fresno. Mike Rhodes talked about how the agencies that the city has sort of handed the homeless over to, Poverello House, other groups that set up what they called, I guess, woodsheds for the homeless as pseudo shelters in order to give the impression that something was being done.
I'm not critical of the various efforts that are made by different organizations that have something to do with the homeless. I mean, it's clearly they come at it from different angles. Often there's a spiritual aspect to it, and some homeless accept and some reject that.
You don't have adversarial relationships then with any of these organizations?
I don't, and I mean that's. Yeah. Uh-huh. I don't think it's too beneficial, and it's one of the reasons that I'm a little skeptical of some of the discussions about suing shelters for not making their shelters sufficiently welcoming to disabled persons. In other words, you force them to widen the doorways and put in ramps and things of that sort, because I don't want to be in an adversarial relationship with those who are doing the best they can with the little they have.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you have at least back in December you had a dozen plaintiffs and 800 people authorized getting records from the city and county to show that they've been arrested over and over again. Has that number of people grown, and how forthcoming have officials been with the requisite documents?
Well, they haven't been too forthcoming. They've been in denial, in part, and what we've had to do is give them more detail to direct them to the documents that we know exist.
Mm-hmm.
And we have another round of discovery that's out there now, and we should be getting responses within a couple of weeks now.
Mm-hmm. What's your next court date?
We don't have a court date. We have a cutoff date of discovery in October. So by October 10th or 11th, we will have gathered all the information we need to move for class certification, to move for summary judgment, to move for preliminary injunction, and that's what will be next on the drawing board. Unless we get derailed into some type of settlement procedure.
And again, it sounds like when you use the phrase derailed, it indicates a lack of enthusiasm for that particular avenue rather than, I mean, you might consider a settlement might be a good thing.
Well, there are two ways you go. One is you voluntarily move to mediation. Another is you're required to undergo some kind of alternative dispute resolution. Now, if it's voluntary, that's great. I'd like to see us come to the table voluntarily, where we all have the same objective to try to address the complex issues that are social and economic, political issues, rather than being forced to be in a room with people who are just putting in their time and trying to get out of there. So I'm not sure how a settlement process will develop. At this point, it looks like we have some willing and some hesitant parties.
Now, in some cities, the legislative process has been affected. For example, in Fresno, the success of the Kincaid case, which is, of course, the case in Fresno with a $2.8 million settlement or $2.3 million settlement, resulted in the eyes of some in the city stepping back from anti-homeless laws like a new camping law. What's the legislative reaction been to your lawsuit at the city level?
We have a contested race for mayor. And I think that as a result of that, both sides are treading carefully around the more explosive issues. Now, I think what's happening is they're trying to formulate policy, competing policy approaches to the homeless issues, and we haven't seen an intensification of law enforcement activity, and I think that there are also budget restrictions that are helping us, because they don't have enough money to squander on what are really non-productive law enforcement activities directed against homeless persons. I mean, they're not a source of criminal activity, aside from status crimes. You know, you just being homeless in a park is a crime under some of our ordinances. So there isn't a lot of it. Contrary to the emphasis on trying to deal with quote youth gangs, that is a sort of a hot button item that's getting funded by state and federal money. You don't find a lot of money pouring into law enforcement against the homeless, and I think that gives us a little bit of a respite from what otherwise has been a pretty intense focus.
And yet you mentioned they're simply using different tools to criminalize homeless people, such as jaywalking. Here in Santa Cruz, they're using littering when you drop a cigarette butt, sitting on the edge of a planter, a whole series of so-called quality of life laws that criminalize and selectively enforce particular kinds of behavior in downtown areas.
I think what that does, though, Robert, and the way I meant to portray it was that they're using those citations to really drive the homeless away from areas that are considered more business-friendly, more commercial areas, because they can't really cite them for other violations, and yet that's the way they discourage them from being in the city.
And usually I find that both here and in other cities, homeless people don't want to stand up and, you know, defend their ground, particularly. They're willing to just move and get out of sight. There's already kind of an internal burden when you're homeless because you feel it's your fault, you know, your self-worth has dropped. And you naturally don't want to be at the mercy you are at the mercy of the police. But have you seen any reaction in the homeless community that's been empowering because of this lawsuit? Are people standing up and asserting their rights more?
Yes. We are seeing that. We have found more people willing to come forward and tell us about their situations. And I think when a sweep has been planned and through some kind of concerted effort and turning the spotlight of the press on those actions, the authorities back down, I think that is empowering. We have a homeless leadership organization that is forming, and people who have the real experience of being on the streets and dealing with those problems are coming forward and reaching out to their friends and compatriots, and I think that's had a positive effect. It makes people more willing to answer the questions and provide the affidavits and give us the information that we're going to need ultimately to turn around and help them.
Foreclosures in different parts of the state, of course, are on big rise. Is that a factor in the new homeless in Sacramento much?
I think we hear stories of people on the streets because they've lost their jobs, they've lost their homes. I think that's always been the case to some extent. And until we get the results of our survey, I can't quantify that.
We're talking with Mark Maron, attorney in Sacramento, who is pressing a lawsuit against the city of Sacramento and the county of Sacramento.
Yes.
I also want to announce it's 9 minutes to seven here at this end of the line. Political activist Cindy Sheehan is going to be speaking in town tonight at the Vets Hall for those who want to go down there and check it out. There's some confusion as to whether it's going to cost $10 or whether no one will be turned away. I suspect if you try, you'll be able to get in if you want to talk to Sheehan. It is a fundraiser for her campaign against Nancy, I Never Met a War I Didn't Like, Pelosi, in Congress, in her San Francisco district. I wanted to interrupt you, Mark, for that purpose because
I failed
to mention it earlier. Mark, how can people get in touch with you or get more information about the Sacramento lawsuit if they want to?
They can call our office at 916-443-6911 or email the office. It's a fairly simple email address. It's office@markmaron.com, and Maron is M-E-R-I-N.
And is there a website where any of this is described in detail, where people, for example, maybe who want to donate money to this cause could contact, you know, learn what's happening and contact you?
I love the idea, but we don't have a website. Not yet, anyway.
Well, get busy.
Okay.
I've got, you know, more questions, but I do appreciate you getting back to me. And
sure.
I think what you're doing is really important, particularly because of the loss of the Jones precedent. That has discouraged a number of people, I guess. Is the ACLU trying to help you at all in Sacramento, or are they a lost cause on this issue?
No, I wouldn't say they're a lost cause at all. The ACLU is a great resource, and they're always supportive. They are not throwing lawyers at the job. And frankly, I think we have it somewhat under control.
I mention that because here in Santa Cruz, they aren't even willing to come out with a statement against the sleeping ban because local politicians are so entwined with their organization that I think they think they're afraid it would embarrass them.
Well, we don't have that problem. I mean, as I said, they're always willing to think problems through with us, to provide legal arguments, briefs, whatever. And we do a lot of work with the ACLU. We have opposed the gang injunction, the anti-gang injunction in West Sacramento, and we kind of picked up the ball from the ACLU, who did the first round. So we work very closely with the ACLU, particularly in Northern California and San Francisco.
Have any other localities been in touch with you and used your lawsuit as a sort of a model from which to work from that are similarly trying to restore rights for homeless people?
We get calls pretty regularly from lawyers who want our pleadings and who want to get some ideas. I haven't seen anything that's been filed as a result, though.
Last time I asked you if you could send me your pleadings, and I don't think you ever did. Any chance of getting them this time?
Well, absolutely, and I'm embarrassed if I didn't do that.
Well, I'm a cruel and vicious guy to mention it on the air, but who knows? That would be part of my sadistic, or
okay,
at least...
Okay, I have your email. It's rnorse3@hotmail.com.
Yes, hotmail.com.
Okay, well, I'll make sure you get those tomorrow, Robert.
I do appreciate that, Mark, and I will pass them on to interested people. And I do appreciate your being available on short notice for this and getting back to me. And, you know, it's encouraging to hear and educational as well. And I'll give you the last word if you got some last words.
Well, I just encourage everybody to be compassionate and to lend a hand and a hand up, too. And if you have a front porch or if you have a spare bedroom and you see somebody who's down and out, you know, make the offer.
Hear, hear.
Okay.
Thank
Carry
you.
On. You're doing a great job, Robert. Thank you.
You too, Mark.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was Mark Maron of Sacramento suing the city, or I should say the county, for criminalizing homeless people at night for sleeping and such like behavior. And hopefully when I get the pleadings, I'll be able to give you more specifics as to the exact legal issues he's raising and the particular specifics he's seeking from the authorities involved. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I was mentioning before I began this discussion with Mark that the city council candidates had a little backslapping session with the SEIU union on Tuesday night. Tony Madrigal is running for city council. He's having a campaign kicked off. And community barbecue to help reelect him. It's 1 to 3 Beach Flats Park, Saturday, August 16th. That's day after tomorrow, 133 Liebrandt Avenue, at corner of Raymond Street and Liebrandt. And you can check that out and talk to Tony. I'll probably be playing a bit more of what happened at the SEIU meeting. And, again, hopefully there'll be something posted. I think, as I said, Becky Johnson is writing something up about this whole issue. She may be listening to this broadcast, and she may have some comments that she wants to make. Anybody else who was at this essentially, I don't want to say closed-door session, because it was, in effect, it was open, but there were pressures not to document what went down in a way that would really be helpful for other people, such as actually hearing what the candidates said. A little music, and I'll be back to you. If you want to call in, you can. 427-3772 is the call-in number of the show. I'm Robert Norse, and the name of the show is Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides. Stay tuned.
My feet are tired. My feet are tired. Oh, my feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. 1955, that was a lifetime ago. Remember, I like Ike. Remember Jim Crow. Montgomery, Alabama, sleepy southern town. Started something when she sat down. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My say, I only want my kids to see a better day. I thought it over and I changed my mind. I want to see freedom. In my time, my feet are tired. My feet are tired. Oh, my feet are tired. But my soul is rested.
That was Ann Feeney, My Feet Are Tired. And my feet are okay, maybe a little numb, not terribly tired. But, I'd love to hear a few voices out there if anybody has any thoughts about anything they've heard. Number to call into the studio is 427-3772. You will be on the air, and you'll be talking to me, and you'll be talking to the community if you call in. So, I talked a bit about the first City Council Forum of the season two nights ago at the SEIU headquarters involving Tim Fitzmaurice, Ryan Coonerty, Don Lane, Tony Madrigal, and David Teresis, plus Jane Weed sitting in for Catherine Byers. Five of these people are ex-mayors or city council members with lots of name recognition and presumably some financial backing. David David is, he was on the Port Authority, I believe. A thick packet was put out. He was transit manager, and he's an attorney at the Santa Clara Valley Transportation Authority. There was, the word homeless only came up when Don Lane spoke. He's the executive director of the Homeless Service Center, or involved with them in some way. Normally I would sort gravitating to him in some respects to have a dialogue, and indeed I did ask him a few questions afterward. He and I are sort of old protagonists in the past. When he was mayor, while he was on the right side of a number of issues on different points, it's hard to say where he was in the long run, and he eventually became a close companion to Scott Kennedy in a lot of Kennedy's activities, which involve criminalizing people in public spaces and duplicity around whether he supported or opposed the sleeping ban law, cutting back public process at City Council, which has been perfected now by Mike Rotkin. And who knows, is heir apparent? I hope not. Ryan Coonerty, who probably is the man to defeat in this election, as far as I'm concerned. But in terms of the issues, a lot of generalities were thrown around. There were some specific questions asked, I wish I could play some of the statements that these folks made. But again, I was banned from doing so by the SEIU, and I wish I'd appealed that to the membership and said, look, you know, the community wants to know it. There are members who aren't here, but, of course, I didn't. I did, however, talk to a few people afterward, make a few comments. I'm going to play that now, and if you have some comments and thoughts, you can call in, 427-3772.
Yeah. So it's about 6 o'clock, near to it, November, August 12th, 2008, at the SEIU Union Candidate Forum. And the candidates are assembling. Looks like several of them I recognize. Tony Madrigal outside, Ryan Coonerty and Tim Fitzmaurice and Don Lane inside. And then there's a couple I don't, or at least one I don't, who I attempt to introduce myself to. I was concerned about the lack of publicity of this event for the community, and I was told by the woman organizing it that it was an internal business to which the public was sort of invited, but mainly for labor, internal labor discussions, quote, in the family. So there's candidate information here, and hopefully it'll be, I don't know if hard questions will be asked. I kind of doubt it, but you never can tell. And the room has about 10 or 15 union members, a little buffet with ginger snaps and such, and several tables laid out where the candidates will be presumably answering questions and making their statements. Hey, Ryan, how you doing? I'm fine. And there's a couple of folks who were candidates in past elections. There's Bonnie Moore, who ran, I think, 4 or 6 years ago. And a lot of union members, I presume they're union members, men and women whom I don't recognize. And so, a pleasant day. The fan is rolling so that we can stay fairly cool, warm, actually warm to hot outside. And soon the festivities will begin. So it looks like the censorship period is over. It's 7:30 in the evening, and the six candidates have spoken. Jane, we represent Catherine Lyons. And again, kind of a closed meeting, which there was actually no members of the media present, and no recording was made, even for the benefit of the people who were doing this. I'm not taking a walk in the fresh air. Hey, Don.
Hi.
Hey, you didn't say much.
Oh, I was not allowed to ask because I'm not the candidate. I'm not the candidate. But they have a reason.
So we have the candidates coming out again. Tony, got a question for you for free radio. Why did you vote for the non-union projects in the last 4 years?
Which ones are you talking about?
Well, let me put it this way. When you voted for a non-union project, why did you do that?
And we'll interrupt this to catch a caller here. Hi there, you're on free radio.
Hi, Robert, it's Linda.
Hey, Linda, what's the update?
Well, did you know that, I guess, you know where they've been having the drum circle, right, over by the farmer's market on Wednesdays?
Uh-huh.
I guess they're going to be moving it over to the lighthouse over in Wisconsin. I guess they're going to build over here or something.
Yeah, there is it depends whether they can fund it, but there is a plan to build I think it's a 4-story parking structure at Cedar and Cathcart.
Okay.
Which is in parking lot number 4 right next to the farmer's market.
Right next to it. Yeah, that's where the drum circle is.
On top of the drum circle, in essence.
Exactly. Oh, geez. So that's why these poor people now got to move somewhere else.
Right.
Sucks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the under discussion in the downtown commission. I actually was thinking of playing something about that tonight, although I haven't really researched their parking lot, their parking garage structure in great detail. But it's interesting to hear some of the preliminary discussions because the staff is trying to run roughshod over the downtown commission, which is not a terribly liberal group, but it's a group of people who have some questions about, you know, where's the money going to come from? How are you going to get, you know, are you going to put in parking meters in other lots? Are you going to put in barriers that require people to pay coming in and out? And they're not getting answers from the staff. The staff is saying, we'll decide all that later. You know, you don't have to worry about that. And, you know, this is annoying some members of the downtown commission who say, wait a minute, we were appointed to talk about these issues.
Uh-huh.
Of course, the problem is that, you know, even if they do talk about them, they'll probably come up with the wrong and the bad answers anyway.
Right. did we ever find out anything about the thing over here at New Leaf about the little gate up? It's still up, I guess.
You haven't been
listening. I'm not usually down here that late anymore.
You haven't been listening to my show, I take it, Linda.
No. Yeah. Well, I don't have a radio with me.
You really have to do that because I can't really give you an individual report.
Oh, okay.
You're supposed to be giving me an individual report for the benefit of the
community.
Yeah,
I know.
You know.
All right, sweetie. Well, I'll let you go then.
All right. Well, keep, you know, if you got some stuff coming in from the,
of course.
You know, please let us know if you see something
on the
streets.
I will do that. You know, I will.
All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And phone lines are open, 427-3772. And, of course, the answer is the chained off one half of the public sidewalk in front of New Leaf Market is still chained off 12 hours a day, or maybe it's 13 hours at night, actually. Through essentially unilateral behind-the-scenes closed-door decision made by the Redevelopment Agency and some maybe the downtown task force or working group or the secretive little committee that Ryan Coonerty and two other council members are a part of that doesn't really take minutes, doesn't invite members of the public, and actually operates in secret through the staff and through the police department. It's what we got for the city government, folks. Here we go back to the SEIU City Candidate Forum. I should say afterward. This is kind of some of the chat we had after. I was asking Tony Madrigal some questions, and I wasn't very well prepared for this. There have been a number of non-union projects, one of which was the Santa Cruz Coast Hotel project, which failed, but which Madrigal supported, even though it was non-union. And various other projects had evoked some caustic criticism from some members of the public. Maybe I can actually get a member of the public on the line to talk about this who is more familiar with the Madrigal's voting record, or at least which of these projects was union and which was non-union. I was asking him, you know, he voted for some non-union projects, I understand. Why was that? And he kept ducking and saying, which ones are you talking about? And I was not well informed enough to give him a good answer, but this is what he and I said to each other.
I don't know. Well, did you vote for any non-union projects in the last 4 years? Do you remember any that you may have voted for?
That's a darn good question, Robert. You know, probably might have been some.
Might have been some. That's your answer?
I wish I had my...
There are people,
you know,
concerned.
I wish I had a list of...
Sure, and if you want at a future point, if you ever would return your calls, we'd be happy to give you such a list. But, you know, I'm wondering, first of all, I wonder why the SEIU management didn't ask people those questions about the non-union projects people voted for. But I'm wondering particularly you, because you're a staunch supporter of the union. So you don't recall any non-union project you actually voted for in the last 4 years?
Oh, you know, it sounds to me like you recall one. Tell me which one it was.
Why did... No.
Tell me which one it was.
Well, I'm just asking you. Have you voted for a non-union project in the city council, and if so, why?
Tell me which one it was.
You're not going to answer my question. I'm waiting.
The Lava Hill?
I'm asking you...
So we have on the line with us Scott Graham, council watcher. Hey, Scott, so give me some examples of...
What was that, Robert? Was that some live stuff or some tape stuff?
That was tape stuff from the SEIU.
Oh, okay. I thought you had him in the...
Candidate. No, Tony Madrigal. I think he'd sooner be at a... Well, we won't get into that, but he's not a man who comes into the studio easily, at least not on my show. But I caught him after the SEIU candidate forum, which they did not allow me to record. But he did state that he... couldn't remember non-union projects he might have voted for, and I thought perhaps you might have a better memory or be able to jog his or the community's memory.
Well, he's voted for, I mean, every project that he has voted for has been a non-union project. And he continues to vote for the La Bahia project, even though there hasn't been a final project approved yet. He continually votes for it, even though he knows that Canfield, the owner of the building, and Barry Swenson, the developer, are the two most non-union, anti-union people in town. He continually votes in favor of their project.
Okay.
As do all of the other council members.
Oh, for heaven's sake. I don't want to hear this criticism.
Yes, I mean, that's the thing. It's not just Tony. I mean, I realize Tony used to work for the union, so he should even be more pro-union than the rest of them. But, see, all of them, just like their moniker that they're green or environmentalist, which none of them are, also claim that they support unions, which none of them do.
So, can you
basically, we just have a bunch of liars up there.
Now, can you give me some examples of other projects that Tony voted for that were non-union?
Well, I can't. No, I can't give you any examples of other projects. Well, yeah, the project down here. What is it called? That art little thing. That's
the tannery.
At the tannery.
Mm-hmm.
Or the so-called artist thing, which is actually a low-income housing project. So, that's another thing that he voted for that is not being built by union labor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the worst boondoggles the city's ever got involved in.
Now, has any council member that you know of, past or present, ever been a pretty staunch union supporter in earlier projects?
Well, they all try to posture themselves, you know, like Crone and Sugar always try to posture themselves as being union supporters, but they would like, you know, the 1010 Pacific, which was a George Au project, was not built with union labor, wasn't even, you know, the various laws on the books besides, you know, what they call prevailing wage, which is basically union, you know, that they have to pay union wage, but also that there's a local hire ordinance where they have to, a certain percentage of the people that are hired on a job like that are supposed to be locals. And they didn't bother to do that either.
What about the Del Mar Theater, that conversion? What happened with that project?
Well, that was another thing. That was another Barry Swenson, George Au
production?
Production. Yeah, that was the two of them together.
Yeah.
And they got, for spending $1 million, because the city bought the Del Mar, but then didn't have enough money to restore it. So they spent about $1 million, probably less, restoring the thing, and they get the place for 30 years. And the city supposedly gets to use it 10 days every year. And like the first year that was the case, they maybe used it 3 days. Ever since then, they've never used it, as far as I know.
Maybe it could be used as a homeless shelter during that period of time.
Well, for 10 days a year, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe you should get that in the works, Robert.
I'll do what I can. Scott, any other comments about the upcoming race?
Well, I just want to remind people, as I always do, that just because there's 4 open slots on the city council doesn't mean you have to vote for 4 people. You can vote for 1 person. You can vote for 2 people. Or you can vote for nobody. You know, I mean, the way it's shaping up, that may be my vote.
Thanks, Scott, and maybe we can have you on when you have more details that we can pass on to the community.
Okay.
Thank you. And, it's important to have the details. I apologize for not having more details. And once I've reviewed these notes more thoroughly, maybe we'll have some more specifics about the actual rhetorical claims of the candidates, although that's, you know, often not much of an indication of what they really will do. More their past records are really what the issue is. Let's hear some more from the discussion. We're going back to me and Madrigal talking at the SEIU meeting, or actually just after it, as people were coming out of the meeting.
You know, the reason why they're...
I don't remember. That's okay.
I was about to say the reason why they're saying this right now is I'm trying to remember which ones it was. They're probably... Oh, let me think. For me... Holiday Inn Express. I think that was one of the ones that we voted for that wasn't union. And I got to tell you, I was the only council member that raised the issue.
Why did you vote for it?
Because I felt that this is a project that could benefit our community. And yeah.
So in other words, he didn't take the line that it had to be built with union labor. He used that it'll benefit our community even if it's built with non-union labor.
I thank you for your candor, and you're invited to Free Radio, as you know, to give more detailed examination of these questions in the future.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks, Tony. Here's Don Lane of the Homeless Community Resource Center. Becky, you were in the front row of the audience. What do you think of Don Lane as a candidate?
Well, he was the only one that actually mentioned the word homeless in his
talk. Don, thank you for mentioning the word homeless.
Oh, my pleasure.
And not that you necessarily... Well, we won't get into that.
Well, you know, he used it because his work on the Homeless Services Center Board of Directors is a big part of his resume. And, you know, I mean, I'm pleased that we have a homeless services center and for the type of services it provides, but I thought it was kind of ingenuous of him to say that... Disingenuous of him to say that that we have an excellent day center now, when actually the rules that the homeless, that the board of directors actually instituted, are no loitering laws or rules on the premises, so homeless people can't even stay on the premise like they used to. I noticed
Don said that he thinks shelter has significantly increased, and I'm not aware that that actually is the case, at least not in the last 10 years, that's for sure. It's true that there's a shelter for homeless families, but for single men, there's been no increase in shelter in the last 10 or 15 years.
Well, he mentioned the family shelter, and Page Smith Community House has shelters that have gone in since he was on the council in, what, 1990? When he was last on the council, and it's true that those programs have gone in, but at the same time, homelessness has tripled since 1990, and so actually we have a larger gap than ever, despite these programs that only serve a few.
Thanks. What about the increase in, or should I say, has there been an increase in shelter for homeless men in the last 10 years, yes or no?
Yes.
Again, how much has it increased?
Probably
people in families, single men.
No, I know. Just at the loft shelter that just is opening.
40 to 60 people.
Yeah, that's actually 32.
32 people.
Men.
It wasn't that standard. The ISS
only at 16 for men.
So there's been, but the closing, the ISSP is closing, right?
Right. That's right. So there's 32 replacing 16.
So there were 16 last year. I thought there was a total of 40 or 39 last year.
Not for men.
And so
there's a women's group, a family group, and a men's group.
Now those
each approximately 16.
I stand corrected. Right. The three groups, if you add them together, is there an increase in shelter with the opening of the new, what do we call it, the loft? And, what percentage of increase are we talking about?
Basically doubling.
So before there were 39 spaces, now there's about 60 more or less? Or?
Well, let's see. There's 40, approximately 45 in the loft between men and women, and the family shelter at the church still continues.
So the ISSP isn't completely closed.
ISSP just is now for families.
Okay, and that's, 20 people?
So that, you know, the family group is a more flexible size, so it can vary, but it's 10 to 20, I think.
Okay.
And it could be in there.
And how can people get more information from you if they want it?
laneforcouncil@baymoon.com. How's that?
Thanks.
That's my email.
All right.
Thanks, Robert.
All right.
And actually, I was wrong, if Don is correct, and I suspect he is, that there is essentially an increase of 20 spaces during the summer, 45 in the loft, which is the second story of the Homeless Service Center, now open as a shelter for the first time in its 15-year history, or actually, no, it's 10-year history, but it was previously called the Homeless Community Resource Center. And then you have a continuing program of driving people out to churches at night for 20 people. That used to be for a total of 40 people, so you have 20 more spaces per night in the summer. Tonight, for instance, you'll have 60 spaces if the loft is open, 45 in the loft and 10 or 20 in the ISSP. That's not double, as Don said, as far as I know, but it is 50% more, and I sit corrected in that regard. Of course, compared to the 1,500 to 2,000 people who are out there, it's a drop in the bucket. And if you also consider that all those people are criminalized, potentially under the sleeping ban, with potential camping tickets at the whim of the police, you have a situation that is really unsavory and selectively enforced and demeaning to basic human rights and dignity of people who are poor and who need a place to sleep.
How can people reach you if they want to get more information about your campaign?
Oh, my campaign. Good. Tell them to go to my website.
Which would be?
TonyMadrigal.com. www.TonyMadrigal.com.
I'm talking with a man who's been listening to this whole procedure. Have you come up with any conclusions as to who you're going to vote for based on this form, sir?
I don't go on record.
A strong, silent individual. But do you have any witticisms to tell us?
I think that there should be, we should keep the public comment short at the beginning of the meeting and then let people talk at length after the business.
So that way, city council meeting.
Yeah, and that way people will be planning talking at midnight for the next month's events.
They can chatter on later on when the council's gone to bed.
The council's going to be there.
You're going to force the council to listen to the public? What is wrong with you? Don't you understand? The council is very busy. It wants to go home. It needs its rest. Thank you, Dave. Yeah, we're listening to Mayor Coonerty talking with a potential supporter here.
Kudos to Blumenthal, but that was pretty good. I expected to hear about it tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Ryan, how can people get information about your campaign?
They can call me at home. They can look at my questionnaires, which eventually will be posted online.
And do you have a website?
I do, but it's not up yet.
And are you willing to return calls even of critics?
Any critics that don't target my family and try to engage in economic blackmail.
Can you give us the blacklist?
Nope.
Oh, dear.
And, of course, what I was referring to there is the fact that Ryan Coonerty, as both vice mayor and mayor, has refused to return calls on the issues of, the most recent concern I had was that he accused me of harassing his family, harassing his employees, and harassing members of his staff. And I wanted to know exactly when and where this had happened, and all I got was silence, which left me in the dark. And also it made me realize that he doesn't return calls from critics. I asked him some other questions on some other issues that were never returned. Phone lines are still open, 427-3772, if you want to call in. I heard a rather brief tinkle on the phone. It's not tinkle. Call back, and you'll get on the air, and we'll have a little chat. There was a question asked at the forum about, and I didn't pose it, because I posed no questions at this forum. I just took notes, that the issue came up as to, what about public comment time being shortened? Was that a good thing? And Tony Madrigal said, no, he's open to extending time back to 3 minutes. That was Tony Madrigal's comment. In fact, everybody was critical of Ryan Coonerty's cutting back public comment to 2 minutes. Coonerty justified it by saying, well, it makes meetings shorter, and that makes them more accessible to the community. Although he didn't, it's a theoretical argument that might have some merit if he actually held evening meetings regularly, but he's been making increasingly, decisions that will cut back, that put the entire meeting on the afternoon session so most people can't come, and eliminating evening meetings entirely. Don Lane said that, and I think that was the best suggestion, if rather than have a really late night meeting, you put it ahead to another day, and you continue the meeting if there's enough public comment and public discussion and public interest to warrant that. You don't shut people down, as Coonerty did and is doing every Tuesday, second and fourth Tuesday of every month, not in August. There are no council meetings in August where they're on recess. But he has made it impossible to talk about, in any meaningful way, more than one or two consent agenda items, and that's where most of the city's business gets done, is on the consent agenda, which happens in the afternoon in the first case, and then the second, it's... It used to be that, as in most California cities, any member of the public could raise an issue on the consent agenda and say, you can't vote through everything. Let's take this issue off the consent agenda and talk about it for a little bit before you vote it through. Coonerty has, by his own decree, changed this whole procedure so that it requires a council member's permission to do that, which is a very rare procedure. It's not done in any other than one other city I know of. and even there it's under attack. The council members who criticized Coonerty for this, not for this consent agenda procedure, but for shortening public comment generally, did not in any way, well, I think on one occasion Tony Madrigal may have moved to extend oral communication, but he certainly didn't use the procedure he could have used, for example, to reopen the consent agenda to members of the public by saying, I will, whenever a member of the public wants to remove an item from the consent agenda to talk about it for 2 minutes, I'll allow that to happen. He has declined to do that. And he likes to pose and posture as someone who's a friend of open public comment, but when he has the power to do it and doesn't do it, one wonders if, in fact, he isn't simply posturing. I don't wonder. I mean, I'm pretty sure that's exactly what he's doing. Tim Fitzmaurice was particularly critical of this procedure. He pointed out a staff report went 2 hours, and all the public got were 1 or 2 minutes to speak. And he points out democracy is sloppy and that there should be public comment. But when Fitzmaurice was mayor back in 2001, he would cut back my public comment time to 30 seconds. And he was the individual who essentially had me arrested for raising my arm in a silent Nazi salute because he thought that was indecorous. So there is a problem with a number of these council people in terms of not acknowledging the rights of the public to be critical of what they do, provided they don't stop the process. And actually, there's a hell of a lot to be said for stopping the process and getting some new process going, but that's not actually ever been, that's rarely been done by the public, and usually as a kind of a protest action, which is quickly snuffed out or stopped. So, let's hear a little more of life outside the SEIU.
And it's about 10 to 8. I'm now downtown.
Way outside, actually. This is interviews on the streets afterward, which is probably much more interesting, educational, and to the point anyway.
Pacific Avenue with my blood pressure hopefully gradually dropping after the city council meeting. There's the Safe Society for Artistic Freedom and
I didn't mean city council meeting. I meant the city council forum.
Or Street Performers Against Foolish Enforcement weekly shindig happening here at its little side spot under the awning of alfrescos, closed alfrescos. The chain has not yet been put up for the New Leaf Market area, the area in front. And who should I see on the street but Donna Dice? Donna, what's up?
Oh, I'm just looking for my gym bag.
You lost your gym bag. What's happening with the infamous broken arm assailant, Sergeant Christian Lamas?
I have no idea.
No inside information on his latest casualties?
No.
And your next date is in September?
September 3rd, yes.
When will you be taking Sergeant Lamas to court, federal court, to sue him and get some damage from him?
Well, hopefully as soon as I can get it out of the resisting arrest.
Have you gotten much community support? Have people called you up and been talking to you about that? Or has it largely died down? What's the story?
Well, I haven't been advertising too much, so I should get more community support, yeah.
How about harassment from, let's step over here a little bit, could we just briefly? From the park authorities, I know that, you know, it's the rangers, even the state parks are giving you problems regarding your RV, which is your home at the moment, right?
Yes, I haven't been in the state park except to dump the tanks, and I haven't seen that bad ranger at New Brighton. What was his name? D.L.? I told you, I think once.
You probably did. I don't remember it. I know that you'd received a couple of tickets for, what, RV 3 feet too long or something?
Oh, they tried to give me a ticket for 10 feet over the curb, which is ridiculous. And then they tried to amend it. And I replied to that, and then they replied only to the original ticket. So
are you still facing any
rubber stamp ticket process?
Are you facing any? I mean, were you convicted of these tickets? Are you still facing them?
It's all pending.
It's all pending. So what pending citations do you face, aside from the false arrest assault by Sergeant Christian Lamas?
Parking 10 inches over the curb. What were the other two bullshit ones I got over a year ago?
And have you...
Because I...
Have you been able...
They tried to put up a no motorhomes or trailer sign. Yeah, that's what it was.
That was the sign that the state made Ranger Wallace take down.
Yeah, and it's still...
Out of Lighthouse Field area.
It's still down. There's still plenty of people that enjoy it out there. I don't enjoy it out there because there's too many threats of violence from law enforcement out there.
Now, have you been doing pretty well otherwise? I mean, in the last week or two?
Yeah, it's painful getting my arm, the adhesions in my arm broken. I still have a long way to go to get my arm overhead.
And I understand your attorney, Ben Rice, now has a, did he have a private investigator actually appointed to look into your case and paid for by the court?
I haven't heard anything, but I'm sure I will.
Keep us posted. Thanks for letting me Shanghai you.
Okay.
And I just tried to contact Donna Dice on the phone. She didn't have anything new to report, but earlier today when she called in to the Huff line, which, by the way, anyone out there can do, Huff line is 423-HUFF, 423-H-U-F-F, 423-4833. Leave a message as to any news that's going on downtown around discrimination, harassment by police, I don't know, interesting poems, you name it. And I'll try to put it forward on the radio. Donna noted that she was awakened at 4 or 5 in the morning with her vehicle parked in the Calvary Episcopal Church parking lot. That now apparently is verboten. Although actually, if you get the permission of a business or a church, and they're only, and for a business, you can have a maximum of 2 vehicles in the parking lot per night. For people who are sleeping in their vehicles, for our church, it's up to 3 vehicles per night, provided you get the written permission of the church, and you have to have a registered, fully insured vehicle, yada, yada, yada. That is a solution that is potentially a good one, but we don't have a lot of charity or organization around the churches and the businesses, for that matter, on those issues. Unlike some places like Eugene, where it's done with a kind of a city overseer. I think there's an ombudsperson almost, who a social service person who helps to coordinate that. We don't have that in Santa Cruz. More from the streets on August 12th.
And it's back to the Safesters.
This is what happens every Tuesday night down in front of New Leaf Market.
And it sounds like more melody and less words at this safe event.
Public access to public space, please.
Here, here. So that means you're actually going to move this shindig into public space over there or not?
No, we're not allowed to block that.
There's not. You're not blocking that. That's a legal space to be in.
Well, it's actually locked up. What do you think that about that?
I'm talking about the space in front of you.
Oh, well, you know, we've been hanging out over here lately. People like park their bikes, so we kind of move over here.
There you have it. Actually, the safe performers were performing over by the fenced-off area, though not in it. That New Leaf Market, Cafe Campesino, and Alfresco share during the day and is now chained off at night. They moved over to Alfresco, the Alfresco's Cafe, and I've suggested that they take back the area in the very center of the sidewalk where it's actually legal to set up a display device, but they choose not to do that. But they do continue their playing. We have a lone individual inside the forbidden zone, but there's often, habitually, a no trespassing chain at night. What is your name, sir? He remains silent. How about a nice pseudonym? No. No is your pseudonym, or no, you declined to give a pseudonym? No. No is your short but sweet answer. No. No.
no, get the fuck out of here, or no at the moment?
No, do.
No, no, or no go?
Do.
Do. This is being so cryptic that I'm going to have to leave this man alone in the criminal zone and hope that he faces a better future than many do on the streets.
It seems like our cryptic spokesperson was saying no dough, and perhaps I need the dough to put in a hearing aid for myself, but we'll let that one go.
Thank you, sir. He nods his acknowledgement.
Over your head, you're going to have to awake instead. They don't allow no sleeping around here. No, mama don't allow no dancing around here. No, they don't allow no dancing around here.
And there is a relatively large assembly of young people, like, gosh, like Asian American or Native American folks. Looks like about 12 folks in a group here on the corner. And Soquel and Pacific, next to the Santa Cruz Municipal sign, which says no skateboarding, no skate devices, no dogs, no alcohol, no bicycles on the sidewalk. And there's sort of a chat happening here.
See you around.
Sort of a friendly get-together. Not much. What's cooking here with you?
Oh, man, I got a good place to stay right now.
Yeah? Anything you want to say for free radio about the new Santa Cruz?
Santa Cruz is better than ever. We have places for the homeless now.
Oh, really?
Thank you, God. Not telling you where.
Oh, really? Okay. Well, they're a secret place.
Yeah.
Actually, I heard about such a place, but I won't be broadcasting it at this time. How about police action toward people in public spaces during the day?
We have. The cops are real cool. They come to say, man, you got to move. It's all good. Everything's working out great.
We've been talking with?
I'm not giving my name.
Give me a pseudonym.
My name is Happy.
Thank you, Happy. Hope you're not Happy John. I hope the same thing doesn't happen to you as happened to him.
Well, we just talked to Tamarack, whose drum you can hear in the distance. And I believe Tamarack was just convicted in Kim Baskett's court of drumming after 10 o'clock at night, and he got an $80 fine. You say you talked to Craig, musical Mike?
Oh, well, I just saw him at court. I was trying to remember what he said. He never has much to say.
Becky, you have a report on Craig Canada's court case. He apparently got his judgment in the PP case came out.
Yes. Craig Canada, candidate for city council, is a convicted pisser.
What a pisser, man. See, that's for urinating one morning when the bathroom was not nearby, an open bathroom was not that nearby, and he was trying to do so without do something other than wet his pants, and he got
there was also an element that he had a lot of gear with him, his backpack, his bedroll, a big heavy jacket and all the stuff. And, you know, it's hard when a homeless person gets up, you know, do they run to the bathroom and leave their stuff behind? Or do they have to carry everything with them? And he was kind of caught in the middle, sort of that event.
The bottle defense is one that luckily was not raised, which I guess the motto is carry a bottle with you and pee pee into a bottle if you can.
Does that actually work? I mean, do the police not cite you if you urinate in a bottle? And of course, this is for men only, I assume.
Women have to learn how to, you know, grow appropriate genitalia.
No. What we should need to do is wear long skirts, no underwear, and just squat and do it.
For heaven's sake. Defacing the sidewalk again, eh, Becky Johnson? He was convicted of that for erasable chalk crimes 5 years ago. Any other reports?
I've paid my debt to society for that one. Other reports? I think the SCIU forum, the stealth forum, that nobody was allowed to audiotape, videotape, or record in any way, was a big snore.
However, we do have to say that unlike an attempted conference with Keith Sugar, our mayor, back in 2000, when I attempted to meet with him in 1999, we were allowed to make notes.
We were allowed to make notes.
So,
if we had pencil and paper, which we brought.
Thank you. And thank you, Becky Johnson.
No problem.
Okay, so I'm here at the Badass Coffee talking with
Veronica Filbert.
Veronica, you guys are all from Sacramento? Or?
Sacramento, yes, we are, and they're from Chile.
You're from Chile?
No, I still.
Well, I won't do it with you guys, but I'd like to.
Please, don't bother us. We don't want to say anything. Please, just like
go.
Call out.
Okay. So I'm here in Badass, and there are five people who are dealt with by the four police officers, which I came into when I came into the incident. Don't want to talk because it's traumatic. It has to do with a $100 bill, and their concern is not primarily. They understand police should be called if that kind of thing happens, but they thought they were treated badly. But
speaking a little elliptically here, there apparently was a bad $100 bill passed at Badass Coffee last night. And the five women who were involved with that, who were from out of town, by their account and by also the account of a witness nearby, who you'll hear in a moment, didn't try to run, didn't try to leave, were willing to wait. But then they got browbeaten by the owner, manager, Barbara her name is, and then badly scolded or scalded by the police. And they were in tears, at least two of them, when I came up to them. One was sobbing almost hysterically, which kind of caught my concern. You heard them essentially decline to talk. Now you'll hear somebody give an account of what happened.
The owner of the restaurant, the woman who was the owner, and the police officers involved. So, one of them, Mary, was crying profusely, and two of the others looked shell-shocked, so it looks pretty bad, and the officer looks like he's about to take pictures of the scene here. It's Officer Burnham. That's what's happening at Badass Coffee at about 15 to 10 this evening. Women pretty badly.
Wasn't also upset with the manager of the place.
Well, that and one of the police officers, I talked to the women involved. They felt intimidated and abused, so you guys should know about that. I don't usually say that to police officers, critical as I may be about something the police department does.
The girl's from South America somewhere.
Chile.
Maybe this is her first time in the country.
Could be.
That's what I'm wondering.
And Officer 151 walks away. She's taking a photo. She's making her nervous about the whole situation. And the five women are leaving the cafe. And the police officers leaving from the other door after having greeted the proprietress. Let me get a free radio quick account. What's your name?
Brent Loucher.
Yeah. You say you saw this whole incident?
Yeah, I observed the whole situation.
What happened?
It looked like the girls came up to the front counter here at Badass Cafe, and they looked to buy a drink. And since they're traveling and they picked up $100 bills from their local bank, they used it, $100, I guess, to buy the drink. And that $100 was passed over to the manager here, and the manager started to accuse them. It seemed like very quickly.
He's talking to the tall police officer, Eve, right now?
Yeah, there's the manager on site, and she seemed to kind of accuse them fairly quickly.
The owner, co-owner.
Okay. Of this potential, them knowing that they knowingly passed a fake $100 bill. And I can tell that the women right away were, number one, taken aback, and they were sitting here after they even did it, and it was like 15 minutes later, so they weren't even trying to leave the establishment after this whole transaction took place, and that they did not accept the $100, and then they took the credit card, and they still sat down to enjoy their coffee. I saw that, and then the manager sort of came back like 10 minutes later, sort of accusing, like, wait a second, I looked at this thing thoroughly now or something, I don't know what she did, but she really got in their face about it, and the girls were very accommodating and said they'll wait for the police officer to arrive, and as soon as they did, they talked to the police officer as gently as they could, but the police officer, I guess, got in their personal space pretty heavily and kind of got right into their face about it, like, you cannot be passing these, and you are, you know, doing this and doing that by passing around a fake $100 bill. And so the girls really took offense by that, it looked like, by the police officer's actions.
Not only took offense, I saw them crying, one of them almost uncontrollably.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. And they said that they just felt basically where they weren't even given the benefit of the doubt at all by the Santa Cruz Police Department here, nor by the owner of this establishment. And to me, it was fairly obvious that people get these bills and they don't know that they have them. So they just, people should obviously look at that. That is an option in this situation. So it was kind of sad to see that. I watched it all.
Did you offer to give everybody a hug? I know, therefore you are just as much to blame.
I kind of did towards the end, but it looked like they were...
Beyond hugging?
They were done. They needed to leave. They weren't even... The American girls weren't even from Santa Cruz, and the other ones were from Chile, so they just wanted to leave town now.
Yeah, I tried to get them to talk about it on the radio, and they were in tears, no. And the one who did... It was hushed up by the other, so it was kind of... At least we have an impartial witness. How far away were you from this?
5-7 feet, just sitting there on the internet, kind of overlooking from my computer screen.
Jump in and intervene between the nasty policeman and the overly paranoid owner, manager, and the women involved.
I saw that the overly paranoid manager owner was really just on her own with this one. She ran with it, and there was no stopping her. When she started, she was right in their face saying accusational comments to them, and there was no way I was going to stop her. And she said, the police are called, you stay put, and don't go anywhere. And that's basically where she went in like about 2 minutes, and I didn't even see her really give the girls any other option. Not that they were even trying to leave to begin with. So it was...
Going to impact your choice of a coffee place in the future?
Oh, definitely. I can tell. I don't even come here to begin with, and I was using the Wi-Fi, and now I'll choose where I use my Wi-Fi service.
America hears and America will respond. Santa Cruz, of course, doesn't give a shit. We've been talking with
Brent Loucher.
Thank you, Brent. And now turn to slow speed, please. Talking with
PBJ.
And PBJ, we're down here at the remnants of the Safe concert, about 10 to 10 after the incident at Badass Coffee. And you yourself said you've been making a habit of visiting the, you didn't say this, but I'm wondering, have you been visiting the Calvary Episcopal Church, the Red Church?
Oh, yeah.
And I understand, I've seen groups of people on the side lawn along Lincoln Street there. Is that becoming a gathering spot?
Oh, it's the church is a place of refuge, and I think there's youth of the day finding refuge in the haven of the church.
Really, last time I was there, actually not the last time, but some times ago, you used to send out the Mexican-American attendant to harass people and drive them away from the lawn. That's changed?
I haven't.
You haven't experienced that?
I can't recollect that.
You did sign an incident with Officer Winston?
Yeah.
What was that about?
He approached me with his gloves on. He was looking kind of like... He was happy. He finally had a warrant on me.
Proctologist approaches him. What was he going to do?
Hello there.
So what happened?
Unfortunately, he had to take the gloves off.
He took the gloves off, and then what happened?
Yeah. And then he wrote me a ticket.
For?
A pot.
And what, were you smoking, medicating without a permit?
No. It was a warrant for being on the avenue and smoking some medicine.
Without a medical permit?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And this was how long ago?
I'd say maybe like a month and a half ago.
The smoking on the avenue was a month and a half ago, or the actual warrant citation by Officer Winston?
On the avenue.
And the Winston's citation was when? When did he come up and give you this warrant ticket?
Couple yesterdays ago.
I got you. Well, thank you for the update, and I'll allow you now to associate with your associate.
Yeah, right on.
How you doing, Robert? We have a man who used to...
He used to
wield a mean video camera. Where's your camera? Bring it. Oh, he's...
And we've just about reached the end of Bathurst Spears Broadsides. I want to thank you for been listening and remind you that if you want more of the same, and considerably more of the same, on Sunday, I have a longer show, starts officially at 9:30, sometimes considerably earlier if we do flashbacks on Thomas Levitt's The Wake-Up Call. You can join me there. There's also a meeting of the Human Rights Organization at its new meeting spot at the Taqueria Vallarta, which is the particular one that is down at Cathcart and Pacific on the Pacific Garden Mall. I don't want to call it the Garden Mall. The Pacific fenced-in coffee shop mall. In any case, it's down on Pacific Avenue at Pacific and Cathcart, 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. That's a group concerned with civil rights for poor people, and you can check them out. I usually show up at those meetings, and if I don't, there are other good folks who do. If you're getting hassled downtown and you want the people to know about it, if you've seen things that you think need to be more broadly known in the community, give a call to the station, 427-3772. Particularly when my show's on, which is, again, Thursday nights. You've just heard my show, 6 to 8. And Sundays, 9:30 in the morning to 1 in the afternoon, and sometimes a bit later. Also sometimes a bit earlier. Again, the phone number to call to leave a message at any time is 423-4833. That's just about it for this show. I could probably run a few more. Well, I think I'm going to do is give Uncle Dennis an extra jump here to make up for all the seconds I've stolen from his show in the past. Again, for those who are interested in confronting Tony Madrigal or congratulating him or just checking him out, he is going to be having a 1-3 party down at the park down on Lebrant Street this Saturday. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Robert, it's Linda again. There was just something I did forget to tell you. The police raided my camp. I was not there, but my friends that are camping with me were.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't give them a 3-day notice. Now, isn't that what they're supposed to do, give us a 3-day notice?
Well, what did they do to the camp? Did they?
They just talked to my friends and
told
you
to
search
leave.
Their property, search my property, ask them what I'm taking meds for. Well, diabetes and mental illness.
You don't have to answer any questions from the police. Did they confiscate any of your property?
No.
Did they confiscate anybody's property?
No.
Did they insist you move on?
Yes.
Did they give you a legal place to go to?
No.
Well,
not as far as my friends told me, no.
It seems to me, under the Jones decision, they're approaching you to do that, even though it's not really a legal precedent anymore. It was successful in Los Angeles, as you may remember,
mm-hmm.
in overturning the law down there that said the police officers can, make it illegal for you to sit, sleep, or lie on the sidewalk. And in San Diego, a similar situation was the case. It's a situation where the sleeping ban is an unconstitutional law, and these officers are doing the same kind of thing. The key here is to get the officers to ask them very point blank, do you have a legal place I can go sleep? If not, leave me alone.
Right.
And, of course, there's it's the rare person who will actually say that to a police officer because mm-hmm. you got a tent, you got property, and you police
right.
officers have all these, tendencies to confiscate that kind of stuff. But
mm-hmm.
no, they don't have to. They don't have to give you a 3-day notice. They do if they're confiscating your property, they have to hold it for, I think it's 60 to 90 days, and they don't. That's one of the weak spots for a legal action against John Wallace and other authorities who do that locally. So
okay.
Well, that's the dope there.
Well, I ran into a friend of mine, and what my friend had told me was, don't really worry about it. Just kind of stay there. Just, they probably won't come back. So I'm just going to wait it out, to see what happens.
Well, I wish you luck in that, and keep us advised.
Oh, I will, definitely. But I thought I'd call you back because there was something I did forget to tell you.
All righty then.
Okay, I'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And that really is it for Bathurst Spears Broadsides. Perhaps I'll talk to you again on Sunday if you're listening, or maybe you can talk to me.
Thank you. There's a chemistry lesson of life, a chemistry lesson of death, where you're scared to touch your own wife for the smell on her breath. There are rooms full of plague in a can, held back by a vacuum seal. It will kill any woman or man like the warrior's steel. Looks very new to me, war without mutiny, war without soldiers, war without bang. The slow hiss of nerve gas will come, as sure as a knock on the head. And why does the animal farm pretend to be dead? There are bottles with crossbones and skulls in rows very tidy and clean. A war where no triggers are pulled, very tidy and clean. Looks very new to me, war without mutiny, without soldiers and war without bang. The chemicals help you relax. It's a war that runs in the veins. Sometimes it burns out the brain, a new measure of pain. It's a molecule war of sorts, a chemistry lesson of death, where the whole human race can abort with a smell on its breath. Looks very new to me, war without mutiny, without soldiers and war without bangs. Looks very new to me, war without mutiny, war without soldiers and war without bangs.
Animals, friends of the earth, don't let them take it away. Friends of the animals, of life and birth, don't let them take it away. They will if they can, they can't if you stop them. Greenpeace really green. Kill if they can, can't if you stop them. Place your body between Greenpeace, really green. Friend of the tiger cub, blood running warm. Friend of the bird in the tree. Fish in the ocean and seals hardly born. Fur coat, fish fingers for tea. They will if they can, they can't if you stop them. Greenpeace really green. Kill if they can, can't if you stop them. Place your body between Greenpeace really green. Friend of the elephant, friend of the quail. animals all size and shape. The tiny robin and the monster whale, man is the big killer ape. They'll kill the albatross, they'll kill the seal, the eagle, otter and shark. Mariner's albatross, this is for real, time to rebuild Noah's Ark. They will if they can, I can't if we stop them. Greenpeace, Philly Green. Kill if they can, can't if we stop them. Have your eyes really seen Greenpeace, Philly Green? They'll kill the elephant, they'll kill the whale, the eagle, otter and shark. The speeding antelope, the slow-coached snail, time to rebuild Noah's Ark. They will if they can, they can't if you stop them. Greenpeace, really green. Kill if they can, can't if you stop them. Greenpeace, really green. Surprise! This is a real.
out of bed.